Good morning. Will you please come and speak with us?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm moving my mask. That's all right.
Okay, very good.
Good morning, Chief Judge Pryor, Judge Brasher, Judge Alderman. May it please the court, the case that we have here goes back 15 years. It was filed 15 years ago, 2255. About 8 years ago, and I think an opinion, Judge Pryor, you may have authored, the court remanded for a merits determination of one claim relating to ineffective assistance of counsel in the plea stage of the case. So we've been waiting a long time to try to get resolution of that issue. There's been a lot of additional litigation filed, but I think the certificate of appealability does really focus in on what's really important. Was there a claim pled that it was conclusively refuted by the record? And I think that the fact that the government cites in support of its position only cases really that, in terms of adverse effect on conflict of interest, only cases in which there were evidentiary hearings and specific findings that for, you know, there were specific reasons why some other factor rendered, essentially invalidated the adverse effect. That is the most strong showing that you can have in a case that this is a case that should have an evidentiary hearing. The underlying issues are of...
Have you alleged enough about prejudice to get a hearing?
We feel that under Kyler we have definitely, we've sought to show a great deal of prejudice in terms of what the anticipated plea deals were. We showed, the record shows what the other plea deals in the case were.
Right, but and correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought that some of those plea deals were about the same as what your client was offered when he had conflict-free counsel.
Well, as I recall, when this 2255 was filed, everybody was already out of prison, as far as I can recall in this case. The offers were generous for people who were completely overwhelmed with evidence. The head of the operation who's whole Operation Millennium operation was out of his office. He got a plea deal that was extraordinarily lighter. The case against Ochoa was very, very thin. The extradition affidavit ultimately turned out to be, as Ochoa indicated, false.
Let me ask you for a specific, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but I have in my notes that Armando Valencia received a sentence of 20 years. Romero Vinoy Ramirez received a sentence of 24 years. So these folks did not get favorable treatment compared to Ochoa. Am I wrong about that?
They did not. Those two did not. Vinoy, again, is a member, head of the paramilitary in Venezuela. In Colombia, there were factors very specific to these cases that made them extraordinarily different. That's why we certainly believed that we could show, in fact, the offers that were presented to him, to Ochoa by the attorney was telling him, oh yes, with the making this deal, we can get you a 3 to 5, we can get you 5 years. All you have to do is buy in. So, I mean, that in and of itself is something.
Wouldn't a necessary precondition to taking a plea be that he was actually guilty?
Well, yes.
But
yes,
didn't he allege, didn't you allege in the 2255 several times, and in a pamphlet that was quoted in the 2255, that he was actually innocent?
There was a sort of a publicity campaign with regard to the pamphlet, a publicity campaign to the effect that he was innocent in Colombia. That is in relation to that.
But the 2255 at page 95 and 96 says that he was, quote, being framed for charges of which he was innocent, end quote. And then it says that the Soy Inocente pamphlet accurately laid out the truth.
It laid out the truth of the extradition warrant's false statements, which, again, has been proven to be true. But the primary claim, my understanding of the 2255 claim of innocence, was as to this jurisdictional nexus to the United States. I think that was more of a legal issue. The other issue is, again, whether the tapes were undisputed for the most part. And we did not even move to suppress the tapes. So the question, again, it was one of these questions of, does this qualify as a conspiracy?
And didn't you allege in the brief in this court and in the 2255 that the Bernal land deal was just a totally legitimate real estate transaction from the perspective of Mr. Ochoa? And if that's true, what kind of cooperation could he have given in response to Ms. Van Vliet's letter?
Well, there was no question that he was present in the office when these people were transacting talking about transacting.
But he didn't know it was drugs.
Oh, there's no question that he knew they were involved in drugs.
That's not what the 2255 says, right?
Well, no. The 2255 says that the Bergenzoli land deal was not sufficient to convict him. And I think that's what the opinion on affirming. It was a 2-1 decision affirming his conviction.
But it also says that that's because he believed that it was a legitimate land deal and that he had no reason to believe it had to do with drugs and a drug debt, right?
I don't know that that is a really a significant part of the case. The reason why the Bergenzoli land deal, it was crucial in that it was the entree. In other words, the theory of the government's case is that he does this transaction in which the Bernal owes him money. He goes to Bernal's office to try to hover around to see whether he's going to get paid. That's the question. Does he go beyond hovering around to see where he gets paid? Those issues, though, of whether somebody goes to trial, whether somebody makes alternative claims in a 2255, they don't affect Kyler at all. I mean, most of the Kyler cases, people did also win.
What about Londoño? You talk a lot about Londoño in the 2255, in the opening brief in this court. The government reads the COA as precluding any reliance on the Londoño representation. And in reply, you appear to abandon Londoño without saying so directly. So I just wanted to know what your view of that was.
Right. Claim 6, which is the claim, addresses both the Bergenzoli component of the conflict, which we believe is one of the most egregious.
Let's assume there's a conflict.
On Bergenzoli. Right. With regard to, it also goes forward and makes, on Part B, talks about Londoño. But as much as it talks about there being a conflict in Londoño, as the COA order points out, it doesn't really pinpoint the time and how it relates. But what it does do is relate facts. And what the case over the next 15 years did do is related. We got finally more information. It was finally conceded during this 2255 that Perez did represent Londoño during a certain period of time. We didn't even have that. Now, maybe we should have amended, and certainly maybe I should have amended the COA, but I'm not trying to amend the COA. I'm not trying to claim that if there's no conflict as to Bergenzoli, then you can still grant relief. I'm resting with solidly within the COA. But the facts relating to Londoño, including all the facts that came out over the next, you know, the Gomez affidavit, all of those facts do inform the adverse effect analysis, which again does not require us to show that, what the offer was. I think Ruffin v. Kemp is just so clear here.
Well, let's say that there was a conflict, okay? Why are we to believe, based on what you've alleged in your 2255 motion, that you've alleged enough for an evidentiary hearing on prejudice, if your client's protestation all along was that he was innocent? Why is there any reason to believe that even with conflict-free counsel, he would have, there's even a reasonable probability of him pleading guilty? He later has conflict-free counsel, and he does, and when given an offer, refuses to plead guilty. Why are we to think that there's enough here to allege prejudice?
I think that We're not proceeding, because of the COA, we cannot proceed on trying to show Strickland prejudice. We simply can't. So I in answer to your question, even though I seem to be trying, I would be exceeding the COA to try to do that.
Right. You have to show adverse effect.
I have to show adverse effect. And the precedent of this circuit, which has never been in the Batty v. Balcom and in Ruffin v. Kemp, is clear that the prejudice is when the attorney, and he's the only attorney that Ochoa has in 1999 and for the first period of the negotiation, the where negotiations would occur with the United States. where the attorney does not engage in plea negotiations because of the conflict of interest. And that's what Ruffin v. Kemp says. And that is the prejudice. And in
was,
this
was,
case...
Was that a case, though? And this one of the things that is challenging, I think, about your situation is that this attorney was represented the client for so short a period of time. I mean, what do you say about that?
Your Honor, the defendant's arrested in Columbia in October of 1999. The first attorney who comes in as of 1999 is working on the case is this attorney.
Mm-hmm.
He stays on the case at least through March of 2000. Throughout all of that period, he is working in direct opposition to the client's interest, not even suggesting an offer to the government with regard to this case, going to the client and trying to extort $30 million for an illegal deal. That is worse than Ruffin.
Was the lawyer in Ruffin replaced?
The lawyer in Ruffin was not replaced, but...
I guess the thing that I'm just saying, and just... You know, this my hang-up, I guess, about your position is that it seems like in any sort of run-of-the-mill case where there's a conflicted counsel appointed at the beginning and then gets replaced, that if your position in this case is correct, then that's an ineffective assistance of counsel claim and there needs to be a reverse conviction. What differentiates your situation from just the typical situation where someone gets appointed and they represent someone from a year, then they find out, oh my gosh, I've got a conflict, and they get replaced.
Judge, I've been doing this for 40, more than 42 years, 44 years maybe. I've never seen an attorney actively try to extort his client so as in a manner to...
Right. Obviously, the conflict here is really, really bad, right? I mean, you've alleged a lot of conflict. I guess my point on the adverse effect is, okay, the conflict's really, really bad, but he represents the person for a year, then he's replaced by conflict-free counsel, then they enter plea negotiations, and the plea negotiations don't end up with the plea.
All of the cases that engage in that analysis do it after an evidentiary hearing to make sure we know the facts, we make sure we know what happened. Mr. Quinone never even spoke met with Mr. Ochoa for the whole two-year period before Mr. Ochoa gets here to the United States. His role was a very limited role. It's the replacement of counsel concept is not clearly applicable here. There's a long period of time involved. And what I'm saying in answer to your question is that it does not open any floodgates to grant relief, just an evidentiary hearing in this case.
Okay, you saved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Let's hear from the government, Mr. Mendez.
Mr. Chief Judge, and may it please the court. Good morning, my name is Armando Mendez and I am here on behalf of the United States. The district court's decision should be affirmed because there was no conflict of interest and there was no adverse effect. For almost 20 years, a version of Mr. Ochoa's claim that Perez operated under a conflict of interest has been argued with the assistance of counsel and no conflict has been found. First, in November 2000...
I'll just speak for myself. I mean, If the allegations are true that the lawyer was trying to shake down his client for a $30 million bribe, I can't imagine a greater conflict of interest than that. So I don't get your point on the conflict of interest prong.
Well, the record conclusively, as the magistrate judge found, shows that Mr. Perez was not operating under a conflict of interest. Based on Mr. Ochoa's, his own evidence that he proffered, the transcripts that were produced in Colombia by his brother show that Mr. Perez was not operating under a conflict of interest, was not promoting Vega's scheme. And I can point to certain parts of the record.
And so I looked at those transcripts, and I guess this is an odd situation because there's been no evidentiary hearing on this particular claim, but there has been the production of evidence. Don't we have to read those transcripts sort of in the light most favorable to the person who's filing 2255?
I don't know that you have to read them in the light most favorable to Mr. Ochoa, but they have been read before. They were read almost 20 years ago when the motion to dismiss the indictment and an evidentiary hearing was held in that case when he made the same claim that Perez was operating under a conflict. And the magistrate judge then, Judge Turnoff, held an evidentiary hearing and found there was no conflict, and Judge Moore agreed. And then Mr. Ochoa filed a motion for a new trial and a renewed motion to dismiss the indictment. And again, Judge Moore dismissed that and denied that. And now, as opposing counsel mentioned, this habeas case was filed 15 years ago. And Magistrate Judge McAlealy looked at those same transcripts and said there was no conflict. And so did Judge Moore on de novo review. And so the government's interpretation of those transcripts stands on the findings of the magistrate judge's findings and the district judge's findings. Mr. Ochoa's interpretations, he stands alone in those. And over the last 20 years, a version of this claim has been litigated. And no judge has found that there was a conflict of interest.
Well, what about the fact that Judge McAlealy appeared to use the wrong standard when reviewing the 2255's allegations?
I think Judge Moore addressed that in his Rule 59 order.
So is that sufficient? So in the order adopting the R&R, he seems to, again, apply the wrong standard. Then there's a Rule 59 where the standard is reversed. Right now, at Rule 59, the standard is skewed in favor of the party that won, the government, and against the 2255 movement, which, as Judge Brasher pointed out, is the reverse of what it was before the judgment. And at that point, Judge Moore corrects the standard.
I think he disavows language that suggested that it was the wrong standard. I think the government agrees with Judge Moore that it's not necessarily that the wrong standard was actually applied, that there was language that seemed to suggest that the wrong standard was being applied. But in order to determine whether an evidentiary hearing is appropriate in a habeas case, it is the standard that Mr. Ochoa needs to allege reasonably specific facts, which Judge McAlealy and Judge Moore determined he hadn't. And if his allegations are refuted conclusively by the record, then an evidentiary hearing is not appropriate. And that's exactly what Judge McAlealy and Judge Moore found in the end. So
you rely a lot on Mr. Quinones' simultaneous representation of Mr. Ochoa. He alleges, though, that Mr. Quinones was really just extradition counsel and had really no contact with Ms. Van Vliet or Mr. Ryan in the plea negotiation phase of the case, and that by the time the conflict was revealed with Mr. Perez, that ship had sailed. Aren't we required to take that allegation in the light most favorable to the allegation, which is that Quinones had nothing to do with plea negotiations?
Well, we know from the record that Quinones did, in fact, meet with AUSA Van Vliet and Ryan about...
Not about pleas.
They discussed a preliminary...
The extortion. They discussed the extortion, right?
Well, they discussed a plea negotiation, and Ms. Van Vliet said that in order to consider a possible plea, Mr. Ochoa would have to waive extradition, would have to plead guilty and cooperate. And that's in the record. And it's an important point to make that Mr. Quinones started representing, according to AUSA Ryan's affidavit that was filed in the habeas case, started representing Mr. Ochoa from the moment he was charged in August 1999. And Mr. Perez, according to the record, did not start representing Ochoa until after that, shortly after his arrest in October. So Mr. Quinones' representation completely encompassed Mr. Perez's representation, because Quinones was representing him from August 1999 to 2002 when his trial attorneys took over. And so regarding Mr. Quinones, Ochoa, if he truly wanted to cooperate and plead guilty, he could have done it through Mr. Quinones, which he never alleges operated under any conflict of interest, but he decided not to. He continued to claim his innocence and proceeded under that. And no deal it's unlikely any deal was going to be possible as long as Mr. Ochoa continued to suggest the extradition affidavits were wrong, continued to contest his extradition, and as alluded to previously, claim his innocence, challenging those affidavits. Mr. Clue references certain cases in terms of Ruffin Camp, and he mentions it in his reply brief, and he mentioned it again today. But that case is very different from this case. In that case, the counsel was representing two defendants at the same time during the trial part of the case, and he was negotiating a deal on behalf of one of his two clients to testify against the other. And so that case is completely in opposite to the case here. And I think it was also suggested in terms of, you know, why wouldn't, what's the harm of having another evidentiary hearing and hearing this case? And I think there would be a significant harm. I think that this, as Mr. Clue mentioned today, this habeas case was first filed 15 years ago. Next year, Mr. Ochoa, it's gonna be 20 years since his conviction. I think the public has an interest in the finality of this conviction. And so, and not to mention the amount of judicial resources that have already been expended in this case, from the magistrate judge almost 20 years ago having an evidentiary hearing, the hundreds of pages that have been litigated and argued with this claim over the years. And so for those reasons, obviously, the law in and of itself, in terms of him not having alleged sufficient facts, reasonably specific facts to entitle him to an evidentiary hearing is one thing, but also the principles of finality, I think, and the judicial resources that have been expended is another reason.
Let me ask you a question about the adverse effect prong. So let's assume that we believe that he did allege enough to say that there's a conflict, there was a conflict. The adverse effect prong, the way I see it, it doesn't actually require him to show that there would have been a different outcome, right? What does it require him to show?
It requires him to show that his lawyer, Mr. Perez, could have pursued a plausible alternative route, in this case, in terms of plea negotiations, and that he didn't or couldn't because he was conflicted. So that's what it would require him to show.
I mean, if that's all, then, I mean, it seems like in any situation where there's a plea, sort of a, you know, someone's representing two co-defendants, for example, and one is seeking a plea, you know, just the facts of Ruffin. Even if that lawyer is replaced by conflict-free counsel, who then pursues a plea agreement, it seems like that standard would be met. Yep. I mean, is that right?
No, I don't think necessarily it's right, Your Honor.
Isn't it?
Well, I think using the facts of this case, I think if the lawyer, if the client, Mr. Ochoa, as it was in this case, is represented by a conflict-free counsel, as is the case with Quiñon, I don't think that we can say that he was adversely affected in terms of his plea negotiations, especially if Mr. Perez's representation was completely encompassed by Mr. Quiñon's, as we've talked about today. I think, and some of the cases that we cite in our brief point to the fact that the Sixth Amendment is an affirmative right, and so if a defendant is represented by multiple lawyers, as Mr. Ochoa was in this case. At one point, he was represented by approximately 20 lawyers. Mm-hmm. If one of them is providing, for argument's sake, ineffective assistance, mm-hmm. and
has an actual conflict. We'll say one of the 20 has an actual conflict, no dispute.
Right. I think that the other ones are providing perfectly effective counsel, and they're negotiating, as is mm-hmm. the case here. I don't think we can say that Mr. Ochoa should be entitled to have a redo. And I think some of the cases actually put it in that way. I think, for example, the Seventh Circuit case, the Stoya case, puts it that way, that to do it, to read to the Sixth Amendment, for example, in that light, it would be as if you're providing the defendant two bites of the apple in terms of, all right, one of your, a few of your lawyers are negotiating a plea deal or not, or you decide to go to trial and you end up not liking the result, but one of your lawyers was providing, for example, ineffective, it allows you two bites at the apple. And I think that that's how some of the cases put it. And so I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, let me give you a proposed rule and see what you think about it. So in our previous cases on adverse effect, we've said something to the effect of that that the petitioner has to show that the attorney did not follow a reasonable strategy. Is it possible that we should instead be looking at whether the defendant had followed a reasonable strategy? That is, that the adverse effect is more focused on whether the defendant, you know, could have pursued a different strategy and not a specific attorney.
I think that reading it, putting it that way, I think supports more the idea of what I was alluding to before in terms of the Sixth Amendment providing an affirmative right. And I think that that's might be what that's getting at. And I think it makes sense to view it that way especially in a case where there's multiple attorneys all also arguing on your behalf. We haven't mentioned that the trial attorneys also negotiated a plea deal, and Mr. Ochoa rejected that as well. So I think in those circumstances, I think it might make sense, something like that, reviewing it that way. I would like to briefly turn back to the conflict of interest side of things. I think the recordings, the transcripts of the recordings that were produced in Colombia that were provided by Mr. Ochoa affirmatively reject...
That's the first transcript, but the second transcript involves a lot of talk by Mr. Berganzoli with Perez in tacit acquiescence, right?
I think that second transcript should be read in conjunction with the first one. I think
that seems unrealistic when we're viewing the allegations in the light most favorable to the movement, because you've got one meeting that doesn't involve Berganzoli, where Mr. Perez, I agree with you, appears to be saying you've got to cooperate truthfully, it's not going to be a matter of payment. But then you've got a subsequent meeting where Mr. Berganzoli is pushing the program, and Mr. Perez doesn't ever correct him, which for an unsophisticated client who's not American, doesn't understand our legal system, could just mean this American lawyer agrees.
I think that, as I said, my reading is that it should be read in conjunction with the first, in terms of Mr. Perez already having told Fabio Ochoa's brother. So these conversations obviously were with Fabio Ochoa's brother and Berganzoli. And he already had told a few days prior that, look, you cannot buy your way out of this. You cannot pay money. I think he made that clear, as Your Honor mentioned. And so his not repeating that so explicitly in the second, not explicitly repeating that in the second one, I think should be read in connection with the first.
Berganzoli, though, asked Perez if he was on the right track or not. Perez responded, "I believe so, but," and then he's cut off. Well, it's more than just silence, isn't it?
Well, I think that that's also part of an issue with the transcripts themselves, especially that second one. A lot of it is, and I think it uses the initials UI, that it's unintelligible, and so there's large chunks of the transcripts that are unintelligible. But
right, but these gaps redound to his benefit, not yours, right?
I think that's right, Your Honor. I think that it's also important to note that every judge, the magistrate judge and the district judge, who's looked at these same transcripts, have found that the interpretation, that they do not show Mr. Perez's, that when Mr. Perez was operating a conflict of interest. They've looked at this and they found the same thing. And so to conclude, for the reasons included in our brief and today, Ochoa has not shown that the district court abused its discretion. The magistrate judge and the district judge did not abuse their discretion in determining that there was no conflict of interest or adverse effect, because those findings are supported by the record. So they didn't abuse their discretion. And for that, for those reasons, this court should affirm the district court's decision. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your Honor, with regard to the contesting that somehow this conflict of interest was resolved years ago, they have a law of the case problem, which is the 2014 decision. It analyzed the same type of argument. I think there's some new twists to it today. In 2014, they made the same arguments that, this was handled before. This court rejected that. And it has been, they didn't contest it again in the district court. It was not resolved before. Whatever hearing they're talking about, Magistrate Turnoff holding at some point in time, did not have to do with this issue, with whether the participation of this lawyer in this extortionate program caused Ruffin v. Kemp prejudice.
What do we do with the problem of multiple attorneys and the adverse effect test, as Judge Brasher was?
My glib answer, Your Honor, is hold an evidentiary hearing. I mean, that's my glib answer. And I think that again, you look at the cases they rely on. Joe Pegg, who's a well-known case. Stoya, they rely on.
So any defendant who has multiple lawyers, if one of them has a conflict, we're always going to end up an evidentiary hearing land in 2255.
In any case where there is a really strong doubt that whether they had, again, the focus in Stoya was you had divided up the work in Stoya. So I will, the judge, I think it's the Seventh Circuit, saying, yeah, if we can find that, yeah, the lawyer that was responsible for pretrial motions fell down on the job, then we will find a prejudice. But we find that there was another lawyer that came in that handled the pretrial motions perfectly. And so it's case specific, and it's not the
claim. Isn't that what the record shows Mr. Quinon was doing when he met with Ms. Van Vliet and Mr. No. Ryan?
It doesn't. The offer, that there's never an offer. He never requests an offer. They never make an offer.
Didn't they say come in and give a full proffer? And what does that mean in our business, full proffer? Plea and cooperate, right?
It is, yes, but it's not what we're talking about here. When we're talking about trying to convince somebody who hasn't been extradited yet to come here, all of the discussions were about sentence limitation. And so he doesn't even seek that. But that's in October of 2000. That's literally a year after Ochoa is arrested. And although there's been a citation, a reference today to an affidavit by Mr. Ryan saying that Mr. Quinon was working on the case back in August, I did not see that argument in the government's brief. I didn't see that argument below. I mean, the notion that Quinon, they didn't present any affidavit by Quinon. Quinon comes in only into the case with regard to 3 months after Van Vliet had already told the agents to shut down the program. This is a very serious problem here. Van Vliet is running the show. Van Vliet is the one who's concerned about it. Quinon comes in. It's already a big problem. That in and of itself shows that they're not negotiating. He's just talking about this issue in relation to extradition. Nothing in this case distinguishes Ruffin v. Kemp because, the time periods are not materially different. In Ruffin v. Kemp, it is as if conflict counsel came in, because once the other defendant stopped plea negotiations, then there was no point in, they were both in equal positions. There was an end to the conflict in Ruffin. It happened to be with one attorney, but there still was an end to the conflict. I think the decision in Ruffin is so important. It is more important that the court maintain.
Is there any allegation in Ruffin that Mr. Ruffin had said that he was innocent and had no cooperation to give?
No, but again, their emphasis on a public relations campaign in Colombia.
It's not a public relations campaign. It was in your 2255. It's alleged in the 2255 itself.
As a post-trial claim, there was an argument that the case was not proven, I believe. With regard to the Soy Inocente whole deal, that is part of a public relations campaign in Colombia. To be denied the rights of the Sixth Amendment because you engage in a public relations campaign in Colombia, it doesn't add up to me. He did. The reason he's got Perez in front of him is to try to make a deal. The problem is it's $30 million too much, or it's $20 million too much. You know,
it says on page 95 of the 2255, once Movement was arrested in Colombia and received a copy of the extradition affidavits, he vehemently argued that the information concerning him was inaccurate and totally false. He circulated a pamphlet entitled Soy Inocente, I Am Innocent, that described how Agent Crane had misstated and lied about the content of their conversations that had been intercepted in order to create evidence against him and to have him extradited, and he communicated this to his attorneys, Jose Quinon, and subsequently to Roy Black.
Yes, and that is all true. That was all validated by the record.
That he was innocent?
He was innocent of the extradition affidavit. You know, that's the whole point. You're trying to fight the extradition at that point. He was innocent of the extradition affidavit. But that is, from a defense standpoint, that was his position of greatest leverage. This point before they cure their extradition warrant, that is his position of the point of greatest leverage. There's ultimately an evidentiary hearing is the only way to get to the bottom of this case. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Krug. We will be in recess until, I think the easiest thing to do is to do it until the top of the hour at 10 o'clock.